Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cyril Regis, MBE, born in Maripasoula, French Guiana, but then was part of France, still is part of France,
it
I
is,
think,
yeah.
On the 9th of February 1958. So you grew up on the northern part of South America, isn't it, really? What was life like growing up?
Well, I was there for 4 years.
Do you remember anything of it?
Not a lot. I remember just the hot weather and dancing in the rain, you know, as young kids, me and my brother and my sister over there. Not a lot, being that sort of age. I can remember my dad having a great big hammock out there and the weather, banana trees, and just a sense of freedom.
And your dad, I think, is he Guyanese or is he from...
He's from St. Lucia.
Right, so that's a tiny little and very beautiful island, yeah?
Yeah, I've been there a few times and got some family there. But he was a fisherman and he decided to go to French Guiana to do gold, pan gold.
He's a gold miner, a gold miner. Panner. Wow.
Yeah, panner, yeah.
So, did he ever find any?
Yeah, he did. Because, I mean, he actually made some gold rings and chains for us when we were younger.
Incredible.
And he gave it to us when we got older, 18, 19, 20, 21. So he left French St. Lucia, went to French Guiana, and met my mum. He was 34, met my mum. Mum was 17, 18. A little village, Maripasoula, 500-600 people. Got together, had three kids there. And myself, older brother Imbert, who's sadly passed away this year.
Really, I'm sorry to hear that.
56. Yeah, my elder sister Neela, she's the oldest. She had three kids.
One of them is Jason Roberts.
Absolutely.
The other two are real people as well, I presume.
Well, Jason's her son has done a great job as a great footballer and an advocate for all things.
Not as great a footballer as his uncle, if you don't mind
well,
me saying.
I always tell him as well he's not as great.
And it's true, I'm afraid. So you go to St. Lucia for a year, and then the family emigrates en masse, or in bits and pieces. We were hearing from Tessa Sanderson a couple of weeks ago on My Sporting Life, and as is typical of people coming from the Caribbean, the whole family can't afford to come, so they come in bits and pieces.
That's right. So my dad left French Guiana. He went straight to England. My brother and my sister went to St. Lucia. We stayed there for a year, and we came over. Me and my brother and my mum came over by boat. The boat was Ascania. I think we logged off in Southampton, took the train up to Waterloo, picked up with my dad. My sister stayed behind in St. Lucia for a year or so. She didn't come over till she was 16. I was 5. My brother was 7, came over here, and we lived in one room on Portobello Road.
Incredible. Okay. So you were 5 or 6 when you come over here. So was it such a shock, or do you not really remember what life was like before you got to England to have that shock, culture shock?
All I can remember is being in this one room and the rain. It was cold. I think we came in February, so you can imagine coming from a warm climate in French Guiana as a young kid.
Why didn't you come in the summer? Give yourself a chance.
Yeah. down to mum and dad.
Yeah.
But that's the way it was. And I can just remember the rain falling for hours and hours, and then it was cold, it was freezing. And living in one room was, and you couldn't go out and that sort of thing. So it was, for a five-year-old, five and a seven-year-old, it was pretty tough.
I mean, you also had some troubles with housing at that time. I mean, various things falling out with landlords. And I think you ended up in a hostel at one stage.
That's right. Well, you know, if you imagine, you know, one room with four of us. Then we progressed to two rooms with seven of us. My mum and dad had another couple of kids, and we brought my elder sister Neela over. So we had a shared toilet and bathroom, and a shared oven on a landing with another family. And we was upstairs and the landlord was downstairs. And with five kids, all the noise, we got turfed out. We went into Dartmouth Road, a hostel in Dartmouth Road, in Willesden. Me, my mum, my brother stayed there. My sister went to the girls' home. My dad stayed in Lambeth Grove with his brother. We then moved. My mum went to the East End, to the Salvation Army in the East End.
Wow.
With my younger brother and my oldest sister. My sister stayed in the home. My dad stayed with his brother. And me and my younger brother went to Aldershot, in a convent in Aldershot. We lived in the convent in Aldershot for nearly 9 months, 10 months.
And did you all go back together again?
We did. Oh. We all got back together again. We had a two up, two down, toilet outside, no bath, in Stonebridge, Barry Road in Stonebridge, before the flats were built. So we all got back together finally, and that was great. And it was, as a young kid, it was good times, because you don't understand what your parents are going through.
No,
it must have been torturous, my mum and dad, looking back on things. I never had a bath. We used to go down to Paddington, Penny Steps Bath, to a bath every 10 days. For a proper bath.
I'm laughing, but it's not funny, is it? I mean,
no, that's life.
There is no glamour in poverty, but if you're brought up in working class circumstances, you it's only when you're 30 you think, my God, my mother and father had to do all that, you know.
Exactly.
So you do settle in northwest London to give it its proper geography. Tell us about your schooling, about your education, and how you got into sport, and tell us about the schools you went to.
I went my first school. I went to Kensal Rise Primary School, and
how was that?
That was good. That was good. It was those sort of days, you know, 60s where summer holidays, your mum and dad kicked you out of the house. You know, go down Queen's Park, play all day.
Yeah.
You know, we used to play football, and there used to be a warden there. We used to pack in.
Is it just me,
bottles.
Or did those summers seem to be? There was never any rain. It was
brilliant.
3 months of continual sunshine.
And you used to stay out all day, didn't you? Mum and dad said, come back out when it started to get a bit darker. Yeah. There was a lot of freedom around. Just go down a park, play on the streets. And so I went to Kensal Rise School. Had a great teacher who taught us about cricket and football. Went there till I was 11. Then we moved into Stonebridge. And then I went to Cardinal Hinsley Secondary School. It's a Catholic school.
Yeah,
all boys.
Yeah.
All boys. You had a great team.
People forget, I think, and again, I'm backing into my own experience here, that there are the English Schools Cup has a separate and parallel competition, the England Catholic Schools Cup. And very, very, you know, teams from Manchester, Liverpool, North London, they're a very high standard, and people took great care. We always are going to be an athlete, Cyril. I mean, here we are now, you're in your mid-50s, and you are a very fit and muscular man. I'm saying next, we're on the radio, people can't see you. Were you always athletic?
Always, yeah. My father, my brothers are big as well, but my father's very muscular, very muscular. And I've always been sporty, whether it's cricket or athletics. But it wasn't until I was 12, 13 in my secondary school that I really found the love for football.
I have to say, you're not the most muscular man called Regis I've ever met.
John's a muscular.
I take it you're related to John Regis.
Yeah, he's a cousin of mine somewhere. And, he is muscular.
He came in and did this programme, and man, he's a cubic human being.
Yeah,
that is something.
His chest is unreal.
Unbelievable, unbelievable. Did you... Did you enjoy schoolwork for other than sports? Did you do all right at the academic stuff?
Yeah, I was average. Average. I mean, it's typical.
But did you try? Because most footballers tell me they just packed it in.
No. No, I didn't pack it in. I didn't try as hard. I mean, my father's philosophy is he was a labourer and he wanted us to get a trade. All I could hear for years and years and years, get a trade. And so we just focused on getting a trade.
And you did. You became an electrician.
I left school at 16. I got a job with Duncan Watson's, an apprentice electrician. I've done that for 3 years, so I'm a fully qualified electrician.
And could you change a socket point now if I asked you to?
It's been a few years.
Because I've got to tell you, the people at Talksport, it would take them a fortnight. So if anything goes wrong, I'll be looking to you. And you, of course, you were playing your Sunday morning football for Ryder Brent Valley in the mid-70s. And we're going to have a break now. And when we come back, we'll be... Because this is not a story of a man who suddenly arrives at Manchester United and is a star player. You're one of those who came through the lower league system and is an inspiration, I think, to many, many players. Should make the point, of course, in the early parts of your life, having come from a French-speaking part of the world, you had a different name. You were Gilbert, weren't you?
Gilbert,
what happened to Gilbert, Cyril?
Well, it's a long story short. Well, in French Guiana, you get three names. You get a name which your parents give you, which is Gilbert.
Yeah.
The name under the saint he was born under was just Saint Cyril and Regis. So in Maripasoula, you had to be registered in the main town, which was Cayenne.
Yeah.
So a cousin of my dad was going to Cayenne. He said, register the boy. And so the reality was, by the time he got to Cayenne, he forgot my name.
Brilliant.
So all he put down was Cyril Regis. So even I got back home to French Guiana now, my grandmother called me Gilbert.
Absolutely.
But when I came over here, my mum didn't want no confusion. So she said, well, just call him Cyril.
And I know Cyril was supposed to be getting on. There's an awful lot to talk about in this section. But, you know, you were born, I say, French Guiana is still part of France. They have the Euro there. And it, for whatever reason, the 300,000 people who live there choose to still be part of, you know, the French mother country, if you like. You don't sound very French. You're not a very French person these days, are you? You're very British, I think.
I've forgotten it all. I'm British. Yeah, I'm British.
Yeah, I just cannot see you eating the snails and pulling on that blue shirt. I'm trying to, but I can't see it very easily.
I nearly went to play with France in 1977.
Absolutely. Well, before that, in 1975, you're an electrician, and you join Moseley Football Club in the Athenian League, wasn't it? Yeah, in Surrey. Did you have aspirations to become a professional footballer, Cyril? Were you one of those who thought, I'm probably better than this?
No, not really. It was, I just loved playing football. I played with the Gattins, Sunday club called Oxford and Kilburn, down in Melbourne. And I just loved playing football and played for the school, played for the borough and played for Ryder Brent Valley. I was still working as an electrician, doing blade day release in college, block release in college and going to building site and playing Sunday mornings. Until, you know, John Sullivan spotted us playing and invited three of us to come and have trials at Moseley.
And you talk about John Sullivan. He's a guy I know came out of the music industry. He was an agent, a manager, a record producer. And I'm delighted to say we can actually go back to the man who, if you like, discovered Cyril Regis. Hello, John.
Hello, it's Danny.
Welcome aboard, John. Tell us about the day you first saw Cyril Regis playing.
I had a call from a guy called Bert Fidler who said there was a couple of players in Regent's Park, and what the one recommended wasn't Cyril. I went to watch the match, saw this guy. He was completely ready-made. I've never seen it before or since, and you just don't see that. He's the way he received the ball, the way he kicked, and he's playing with kids. People said to me, how could you discover a player playing with children? I said, you have it or you don't. I mean, my only way to prove that to you is to say, like Ronnie Allen, he paid $5,000 out of his own pocket to convince his club to sign the boy. You have to, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And then from there, that was on a Sunday, Danny, and in midweek, we used to have the London Floodlight League, and you could sign a player 5 minutes before kickoff.
Right.
And I put him in at Tooting and Mitcham, and the guy was an absolute star, scored a couple of goals, and my player said to me, my coach didn't want me to play him. He couldn't believe I was doing such a thing. But you see, that would be the same as Ronnie Allen would have sworn. If this guy had good players around him, he's going to do the business. And that's exactly why I think Ronnie Allen signed him.
What do you
That was great fun. I mean, hi, John. How are you doing?
Hello, Cyril.
It was great days. I mean, coming off the building site, you picking me up, driving me down to Moseley.
Presumably in a pretty flash motor.
Oh, yeah, a Pontiac Firebird, a gold one. I said, come back there. I should be sleeping on the car. Johnny's going flying up to Stonebridge, drop me off, go home. I had to get home at 1, 2 o'clock and get up at 6 and go back in the building site. And John looked after me.
Well, John, it's great to talk to you because it's fair to say you did discover an absolute superstar. Well done. Thank you very much for joining us.
All right, Danny, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
John Sullivan, the former manager of Moseley, who discovered Cyril Regis, who got 27 goals from Moseley in 1975. In 76, you moved up a level to Hayes in the Isthmian League, very much your local team, really, if you're from that part of the world.
Yeah, Hayes Middlesex, you know, just around the corner from actually where I was studying. That was at Norfolk Park. A college down there. I was studying my electrician exams down there, so it was very close. Yeah.
And we'll skip straight on to May of 1977, where West Bromwich Albion come in for you. I mean, talk about out of the blue. I mean, you're a good player in the lower leagues, but this is a team, you know, one of the top teams in England.
It was.
There's a legend, isn't it? Ronnie Allen, who was the coach rather than the manager, Johnny Giles.
He was a chief scout.
And he said he would buy you with his own money if necessary. He was so convinced.
Yeah, that was. I mean, I don't know how truthful that is, but that's what comes out of it.
Doesn't sound very likely, does it?
Comes out of it, but I was there for a whole year, and there was always, apparently Millwall wanted me, Gordon Jago wanted to buy me, but the director says, no, I'm not quite right. There's always scouts coming around Arsenal and Reading and different people, but it wasn't until Ronnie Allen came down and persuaded Albion to buy me that they all kicked off. Up till then, never had a trial, never had anything with a professional football club.
It's interesting that, I know that in a pre-season friendly with Hayes, you played against a side, I can't remember which one it was now, with Alan Devonshire in it. These were the days...
Southall. Yeah.
These are the days when sort of two of you end up in the England squad, you know. I mean, they were still finding players out of the lower leagues who would come through and be good enough to play for England.
Well, that's right. When I went to Hayes that first year, we played a pre-season game against Southall, and in Devonshire, he skipped past us. You could tell he'd be a great player.
Yeah.
And he went to West Ham that year, and I stayed and went on to Hayes for a whole year, stayed there.
And how much excitement was there when you went to West Bromwich Albion? It was scary.
I just got a shout. I've just passed my exams in May 77 as a fully qualified electrician, which was great for my dad because he always wanted us to have a trade, and I knew that if it didn't happen, I've always got something to fall back onto.
I was still laughing at the prospect of you stripping down a sub-power station, you know.
Well, I've done it all. It's installation. So when West Brom came in, and my dad said, do what you want, son, so long you've got something else to fall back onto just in case it doesn't happen. And I went up there. I went up there with the then manager, Bobby Ross, and he negotiated a contract for me. I got £60 a week, £30 appearance, I signed a year's contract, and... moved up to Smethwick.
What did you make of the West Midlands when you first got there?
I was bored. I mean, if you imagine, you're talking about doing an 8-10 hour on a building site, all of a sudden you're playing football, you get there at 10 o'clock, you start at 10:30, come 12, 12:30, it's all finished. I was bored, because you used to work until 6-7 o'clock at night. So it was a lot of getting used to. Plus, training every day was very physical on the body. That took me some time to get used to.
Well, you got a flying start at West Brom. I mean, your career at West Bromwich Albion may have had some problems in the latter stage of it, but at the start of it, you scored on two goals in your debut in the League Cup tie against Rotherham. That was the 31st of August 1977. A goal on your league debut against Borough, a winning goal. And also at this time, I think this is an 18-year-old, I think.
19.
And you meet Laurie Cunningham, the fantastic and later Real Madrid and England winger.
Yeah.
I know, played a big part in your life. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, back in those days, you never mixed too much with the first team. Yeah, I was in reserves. And I remember really meeting Laurie on my debut in the dressing room. You had Willie Johnson. You had a fag in a corner, having the fag, and the television, everybody getting changed. And I'm getting stripped. I don't even know my teammates. And I'm going out there in front of 15,000 people. The most I've ever played in front of 500, and there's Laurie Cunningham here. He said, all the best, well done. All the best, all the boys are encouraging me. And that was the first time, and after that, we got on really, really well. But funnily enough, after that game, we won 4-0 against Rotherham. Me, Laurie Cunningham, and Cantello, and a few other boys went to the Hawthorns pub.
Right.
I didn't get at it at 3 a.m.
Yeah. So you're learning about football in the 70s now, aren't you?
This is professional football in the 70s.
Yeah.
If it's good enough for them, it's good enough for me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll talk about the drinking culture as we go on. We should also talk about, because I know it's going to come up because of the yourself, Laurie and Brendan Batson in that West Bromwich Albion team. You are part of the generation. You may tell me there were others before you, but you're part of a generation of black players who now, you don't even blink or whatever, but... How difficult was it coming through to you? I mean, I know you faced some racial abuse, for instance, at Newcastle, but was that as common as people say now? What was the situation?
It was unbelievable.
Seriously?
Really was. I mean, to paint the picture, yeah, the first division, there was only four black players playing in the first division at a time. Three of us at West Brom,
yep.
Laurie Cunningham, myself and Brendan Batson.
Yep.
And Viv Anderson at Forest. So you can imagine three of us, going to teams like Newcastle, West Ham, Chelsea, when they had no black guys, and there was a kind of recruitment of, of hooligans and far-right people from the National Front at these football clubs. And so the amount of stick we used to get was... It wasn't just one or two people. No. We're talking 5,000 to 10,000 people shouting racist abuse at us. It was absolutely horrendous. Throwing bananas on the pitch, monkey chants every time we got the ball. And this went on for years.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think what we've done with it, it got you angry... But you internalise that anger and use it as motivation.
It's funny, I've got to say this, because you must speak as you find it, because it's not aimed at me. I don't remember it at Tottenham in the 70s and 80s. Now, whether it was there, you can tell me about why it's...
Well, Tottenham used to sing this song, Who's That Up a Tree, Big
really?
Cyril?
See, now,
you
I
can't
don't,
remember
No,
that.
I don't remember it. No. I must have been stood in the wrong part of the ground.
You must have had a few beers.
That wouldn't be... Not, well, yeah, a few, that's
I can
fair.
I can remember that.
Absolutely. No, I'm asking you because I wanted to make sure my own memory isn't playing tricks on me. So it doesn't matter whether it's in, Tottenham's the ground is in a predominantly black area. It doesn't matter. It was there. We'll talk about this more when we talk to Brendan later in the show. Because of course later on we'll talk about your nephew who Jason Roberts, who has been at the forefront of the recent issues involving racism between crowds and players. Very quickly, your manager at West Bromwich Albion by the 77-78, Johnny Giles goes, and eventually Ron Atkinson turns up and starts to build a great team. The first sign of the great team was losing we got to semi-final of the FA Cup and lost to Ipswich. And that first big disappointment of your career, really, is it?
Very big. You don't realise what football means to the community until you get close to a cup. And don't forget, the FA Cup was huge in our day. You know, there's only three ways you ever played at Wembley, and everybody wanted to play at Wembley. It was iconic. England National, FA Cup, League Cup.
Yeah.
If you ever wanted that, you never got to play for Wembley. So it was deep in our hearts to play at Wembley and to be favourites against Ipswich. Down at Highbury and losing 3-1 was painful. The coach on the way back was... And we had a very, very good side.
You beat Manchester United on the way, and you'd beaten Derby, Nottingham Forest. Forest were a great team at the time.
But we just never performed on the day. We just never performed. I mean, there was a story that Big Ron went up to Wembley and he'd done a film set, and Bobby Robson just used that as motivation. Says, look at him there. You think they've won it already. And we're underdogs. Get out there, show what you got. And we lose 3-1.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
So after that amazingly successful first season at West Bromwich Albion, when you arrived fully formed in professional football, despite losing that semi-final, there was talk about you moving on, possibly, to St Etienne. How serious was that?
Well, very, very serious.
They were a top team, incidentally, at the time.
It was, with Platini and Trezor and Rochteau. They had a very good side.
They came very close to winning the European Cup, didn't they, St Etienne?
That's right.
And they had lovely green shirts, yeah.
Well, what happened was because I come from French Guiana, I could have dual nationality. And be,
can you, sorry, this is a stupid question. You can still speak French, can you?
No.
Pity you must have spoken French when you were a kid, yeah? A child?
In fact, it was a broken French. It was,
oh, was it
patois.
Kind of patois, was it, yeah?
Okay. It was patois. I don't. So at the time, they saw that I was French, and they thought, well, if I can get him into Saint-Étienne later on, he could play for France.
Yeah.
But I decided to stay in England.
Okay, hang on. And do you ever regret that? Do you ever think you could have been a French footballer, French international, and all that?
I don't regret it because I'd only been in the game 1 year. I was only 20. They came in for me for £750,000, which was an enormous amount of money at the time. But I just thought, well, if I only been 1 year in the game, I could go another time. Plus, we had a very good side at West Brom. It wasn't as if we were a poor side. We had Willie Johnson, Tony Brown, Brian Robson. We had a great side. So
the young Robson, wow.
Yeah, he was a phenomenal player. Derek Statham.
Great fullback. We should talk about. I mean, we'll talk about your strike partner Ali Brown. But Tony Brown was a central midfielder, and I can't tell the kids this enough these days, who used to get 20 to 25 goals a season from midfield, as well as being a tackle and pass, a kind of mixture of Paul Scholes and Frank Lampard, I guess. Yeah. And he got one England cap. I mean, it's extraordinary.
He is Mr. Albion. I mean, been there for 20 years. He's an absolute legend for West Brom. A great guy, a real professional footballer, a real model professional. His goal-scoring exploits from midfield is legendary with Jeff Astle, all the players he's played in. What a fantastic player. And you're right, he is the modern-day Scholes. And Lampard, 20 goals from midfield. Used to run past me. He's doing more running, he keeps telling me.
Okay.
Well, his ability to get in the box when the ball's wide and scoring goals from all angles is phenomenal.
Okay, well, we talked about it briefly. Westbrook, I mean, a very young Ron Atkinson comes to the club and it starts to build around those players a fantastic squad of players. Yourself and Laurie Cunningham are already there. And Brendan Batson, these days, so familiar to us because of his work at the PFA, of course. Comes and so that you're the first team, top flight team in England, as we said, with three black players who are regular in the team. Mm. Did you realise at the time how significant that was?
No, not at all. To be quite, just a bit of history. Johnny Giles laid the foundation for the Albion style of play, and Ronnie Allen built on it, and Big Ron added to it. But the significance of three of us there, you know, it's hard enough to be a professional footballer staying aside. You know, you've got players like Ali Brown, David Cross, and a few other strikers. They want your place. So your focus is to stay in the side. If you didn't perform, didn't play well, at the side.
Well, I'm delighted to say we're joined on the line now by your former teammate. As I say, very much somebody who we're very familiar with here at TalkSport, particularly through his work over the years with the PFA. I'd like to say we're joined by Brendan Batson. Hi, Brendan.
Afternoon, Danny.
Hi, Brendan.
Cheryl.
How you doing, pal? You all right?
I'm not bad, mate. Watching the snow come down here in Birmingham at the moment.
Oh, there's nothing down here, mate. It's clear in London.
Yeah. You want to get away from Birmingham, Brendan. be honest.
I'm going out of snow and rock and buying some extra skis, mate. Yeah.
Brendan, we may talk about this thing where Ron declared the three of you, Laurie and Cyril, the 3 degrees. I don't know how politically correct that is even anymore. I've got to be honest.
You've heard it a few times.
After the singing trio of the same name. But first of all, Brendan, before we talk about that, I think it's more important to remember, or as important to remember, that West Bromwich Albion was a great football team at the time, and the social significance of what they're doing sometimes overlaps the fact that there was a bloody great football team.
That's right, and we were the sadness of it that we were that team for 1 year, because at the end of that season, 78-79, we lost Lenny Cantillo, who was a terrific part of that team, and also Laurie Cunningham to Real Madrid.
Yeah.
So people talk about it. I mean, I only played with Laurie for one season and a bit, maybe 15 months. But what a player. But that team, sadly, you know, broke up after really one season and never really got built upon over the years, because we lost both Brian Robson and Remy Moses a couple of years later when we went to Man United.
I mean, just to say that I think I was reading in some part of Cyril's book that 78-79, when you actually finished, I think, third, a point behind Nottingham Forest and 9 behind Liverpool, eventual champions, Cyril believes that you should have won the title that year. Is that a view you share, Brendan?
Well, there's a lot of ifs and buts around that. I mean, for up until Christmas, up until we had a big freeze when we didn't play for 6 weeks, we were playing some fantastic stuff, not just as a team, but individually. Our performances were very, very good. And then we had the big freeze, didn't play for 6 weeks, managed to get out to, I think it was Guernsey, for a couple of games on grass against Birmingham. And our next game back was Liverpool away. We lost 2-1. And unfortunately, because of the glut of games come in, we never really recaptured that consistency. We still had good performances, but didn't really recapture that consistency of the previous good few months, first half of the season. We only needed 1 point, didn't we, Cyril, from the last two games to finish runners-up.
That's right.
We couldn't manage that.
Yeah, we went to Bristol, didn't we? Playing at Bristol, and my legs, you thought you was running and sprinting, but our legs were hanging off.
We lost
1-0. I think Villa done us a favour, didn't they? They done us a favour and we just didn't capitalise
it at all. Just to remind you that the excellent group of players you had been somehow Ron Atkinson had worked in, and certainly entertainment value, and you both, as you say there, you were top of the league in January 1979, and you got there by beating on the last day, or December 30th, in the run-up to the new year. You'd gone to Old Trafford and won by 5-3. Yeah, there was a time then when people like me, perhaps untrained eyes, thought, wow, West Bromwich Albion are going to be champions of England. As you say, the games killed you both, and eventually Liverpool won the title. But that team...
Cyril had 20 chances in that game.
Yeah, that was the only one he took,
Gary Bain was out of his skin. He played out of his skin, Gary.
Hang on, by definition, you're saying then, Bren, you could have got 10 at Old Trafford,
Easily, even. He could have had at least 7.
Brendan, I mean,
that was a great goal.
I mean, and it was a great team too. And people of a certain vintage look back on it with great fondness. But there is also, as I say, a social significance to it, that it was perhaps odd or perhaps brilliant, I'm not sure, that the arrival of numbers of black players in the top level of English football. In fact, they all happened at one club, really. I mean, we talked about only 4 players in the top level. How important was it that you and Laurie and Cyril all came through together and led to a path where I hope that the colour of people's skin, despite recent events in the Premier League, has become absolutely as irrelevant as the colour of their eyes.
That's very true. I mean, and we should applaud what's gone on and acknowledge the improvements around the game since black players came to the fore, particularly in the early 70s, that explosion in the late 70s. And I think I heard Cyril mention earlier, you know, we were more concentrating on, you know, retaining our form, making sure we're in the team. I think the social significance really passed us by.
Yeah.
Every now and again, it touched us because, I mean, there were incidents, obviously, that were very unpleasant, going to ground, seeing the National Front, you know, trying to recruit outside grounds, the authorities do nothing about it. Having your nearest and dearest, you know, your parents, your wives, your girlfriends, not really wanting to come to the games because of the abuse that we were getting on the field. But, you know, it's a credit to the players, particularly of our generation, our era, that despite all that, they kept on coming forward in ever-increasing numbers. And I think the thing around the West Brom is that with all the publicity we had, which, you know, at times were in reflection, maybe he went on too long and centred on the three of us, Laurie, Cyril and myself, was that we were a very, very good team.
Yeah.
And without that, we wouldn't have had that sort of publicity. And, you know, our individual performances made people sit up and, you know, Cyril was getting a cap and Laurie was there or thereabouts. And we had tremendous players coming through. Derek Statham, who's one of the purest footballers I've ever played with. And Brian Robson, who was going to go on and dominate the game in midfield for many, many years. And look what he's done for Man United in England.
Well, listen, thank you very much indeed for those recollections about that brilliant West Bromwich Albion team of 78, 79. Thank you very much there to Brendan Batson. Thanks, Brendan.
See you, pal.
Good to see you, mate. Good to listen to you. Cheers, Danny. Thanks.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Brendan. Of course, always good to hear from him. Before I come on to the fact that you were Young Player of the Year that year as well, just a last question about Ron Atkinson. Insofar as we heard about all the publicity he made of it, he may have made too much of it. Of course, in recent times, he's had publicity of an altogether other kind. But I know that you've been in touch with Ron since, and I know that if you believed he was a racist after what happened to him, that wouldn't have happened. You just wouldn't have allowed that in your life. Well, so you clearly don't believe that that's the case.
Well, it's clear he made a racist comment on radio. He's showed a lot of remorse about it. I've known him for well over, since I was 19, loads of years. I've had great fun. It's still great company. He came to my book launch. We're still great friends. He's very remorseful and sorry for what he says. As human beings, we are. He's not a racist, a very good friend of mine, and, you know, he should be back on television, to be quite fair.
Okay.
We forgive him, get on with it. None of them's perfect. But he's shown remorse and he's sorry about it.
Okay, well, listen, thank you very much indeed for that. And I should make the point, you were the Young Player of the Year in 1979. Can you remember who you're up against for the award?
Laurie Cunningham. It was quite,
Laurie?
Yeah, it was Laurie and a few others. I think Glenn Hoddle and a few others. But it was
just Glenn Hoddle and Laurie Cunningham then, yeah?
It was quite embarrassing, really, because on the clips showing me scoring goals, it was always Laurie Cunningham going down the wings, keeping past two or three, slipping me and getting across, and I'm scoring. So I thought it was Laurie, but it ended up to be me. So after 1 year in the game, winning the Young Players of the Year by your fellow footballers was, you know, it's a massive highlight, you know, getting that endorsement from your fellow players.
Cyril, we heard from Brendan Batson there that great team of West Bromwich Albion had in 79, they were still a very powerful club and they could buy players and all the rest, but when Laurie Cunningham, your mate Laurie, went to Real Madrid, bless him, was that, and Brian Robson went to Manchester United a little later. Was that the kind of decline of that West Bromwich Albion team?
Yeah, 100%. Two great players left. Len Cantello, he had formed a fantastic relationship with Brian Robson in midfield. Me and Laurie up front, although I had an equally good relationship with Ali Brown.
Alistair Brown, yeah.
Yeah, Ali Brown. And we had the two defenders at the back, Weil and Robertson. They were fantastic.
There may have been individually harder defenders in the English League, but were the hardest pair of defenders that any club has ever had were John Weil and Alistair Robertson. Yeah.
Derek Stather and Brendan Batson.
They were solid.
And so Laurie and Len went, and we brought in Gary Owen and Peter Barnes. Great players in themselves, but what missed was the chemistry.
Yeah.
The chemistry that we had.
It's about teams, isn't it? As always, rather than just players.
Good players, and the chemistry that Len Cantello had with Brian Robson, me and Laurie, it just fizzled out. And 2 years, 3 years later, Brian went and Remy Mozut went, and it was downhill from there.
I mean, you we'll talk about, you were still playing very well and you had a great reputation, you were scoring great goals. How hard was it for players at a club like West Bromwich Albion, do you think, to get into the England squad?
Very hard. I mean, don't forget, Liverpool dominated everywhere.
Yeah.
Liverpool, Arsenal, and I don't think I'm speaking out of turn. The press was London, Liverpool and Manchester. And we weren't getting headlines. I mean, so to speak, someone like Tony Brown, who scored 200 goals for midfield for West Brom, only got one cap.
One cap, yeah.
So the press was more leaning to the Arsenals, the big boys in London, and Man United, and especially Liverpool dominated. Liverpool used to have 6 or 7, 8 players in the first team. But also then, there was, you know, 80% English players in the Premiership. Now it's only 29%. Yeah. So to get in was hard. I had to get past Johnson, Mariner, Keegan, Brookin, Wythe. All these boys were there playing good football, so you had to wait your turn.
Okay, well, you had a couple of seasons then when it didn't go quite so well for you. But I would say, end of 1980-81, Ron Atkinson leaves. He goes off to Manchester United. As you say, he takes Brian Robson with him. Was there any danger that he would take you with him as well?
There was talk, but it never materialised. I think it was so hard to get Brian out. And to be quite fair, he was a fabulous player. The best pound for pound, the best all-rounder I've played against and with. And he took Brian Robson and Remy Moses. I think he wanted myself and Derek Statham, but the aggro he had getting Brian Robson out, he went, you know what, let me move on from here. So to see them go was really sad to our system. Ronnie Allen came back. He was the manager. And had a good spell underneath him.
Well, although the club did very... I mean, you had a very... 81-82... a really weird season in that you finished 17th in the league.
Yeah.
You scored a ton of goals.
Yeah.
You reached both cup semi-finals, losing to Spurs in the League Cup semi-final and to QPR in the FA Cup semi-final.
Clive Allen.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about the semi-final against Spurs. Am I right in thinking, didn't Martin Yol, in those days, a skinny man with long black hair, play with you?
Yes, he did.
And he's a hard case, isn't he, Martin?
Well, he used to put his tackle in, mistimed tackles.
Was it that semi-final? Did he knock Tony Galvin out and get sent off in that semi-final with a punch?
I can't remember.
I think he did.
Did he? I can't remember.
When I brought this up with Martin, he just said to me, I don't really remember that. but he did. Yeah, one of the reasons you didn't win that semi-final is that Martin was sent off for decking. And Tony Galvin was no shrinking violet himself.
Good player. I remember Clive Allen scoring off Alistair Robertson's leg at QPR. But yeah.
And you made your England debut in February of 1982. What do you remember that?
Well, I remember getting a letter through the post. This is sort of like 5 years after being a professional footballer. That's what it took you, you know, from 77 to 81, 82.
Well, you've gone from electrician to international footballer in 5 years as well. You could look at it that way.
Yeah, I could do, yeah. But there were so many good players in front. And I was scoring 15 to 20 goals a year there. And there were so many good players in front. You had to wait your turn. And it wasn't until, I think Bobby Robson gave my debut. And it was announced in the papers and all that. A couple of days later, I received the letter through the post. And I opened the letter, and
I should make the point it's going to be against Northern Ireland. And yeah. That's maybe impertinent to what you're going to say next.
Yeah. Great Pat Jennings was in goal. And I got this letter through the post, and it basically said, if you put your feet on that Wembley turf, you get one of these for your knees. And it was a bullet came through the post. Yeah.
Why had they sent you that?
Well, you know, you're black and you're representing your country, and they don't want you to. I stuck it up. We had a laugh about it, and got on with life.
I mean, I'm sorry. You say you got on with life. Even at this distance, I must say I find it incredible that things like that were happening, and that you managed to continue to be a professional footballer. Because of course, it's designed to intimidate you, and exactly. The last thing you must do is be intimidated.
100%.
Because these people are not going to confront you face to face, are they?
Well, you realise that the chanting and all the issues was confined to the arena. I mean, if you was walking down London or Birmingham, or your wife, your kids was getting intimidated at school, in your home, the bricks through your car, that'd be a totally different thing. But it's confined to the arena, and we had something to fight it with, and that was our talent. And we had a very good side. Brendan was saying, you know, we had a very good side. We can get out there, we can play football, and we played it very well.
You didn't get to the World Cup, although you got into the England squad in February of 82. There's a World Cup, of course, in Spain to go to. You got hurt.
Yeah,
do you think you would have gone if you hadn't been hurt?
I think I would. I was Midlands Player of the Year. I come second to Kevin Keegan in the PFA Player of the Year that year. And I think one of the change was Ronnie Allen came back. He was the first manager I played for who was a striker. And anybody who knows me says I'm very big on power, big on speed, low on stamina. And so when he came back in 81, 82, he said, I don't want you chasing full-backs, coming back for free kicks, coming back from corners. I want you to do all your damage in that half.
Do you think
pitch.
That knock is true? That you did you lack stamina?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, yeah.
Because I mean,
powerful
just
a bit. I'm a sprinter.
Well, let's talk. Yeah, exactly. Let's just talk very briefly because there'll be some teenagers listening to this who won't remember you playing and may not have seen the grainy clips of you doing it. And just to remind people, my memory of you, and tell me if this is wrong, is that you got your goals by people would get the ball to you in on the edge of the box or just outside the edge of the box at your feet. And you had the speed and the physical power to brush past defenders, and you would slap the ball past the goalkeeper, but they might as well have not been there.
Yeah.
I guess Les Ferdinand used to get goals a bit like that, some, you know, 15 years later.
Yeah.
Is that about right?
That's about right.
Yeah. You're not showing off. It's just true. I'm telling you, because I can see it in my mind's eye as clear as day.
But that was, I mean, most of your goals are made by other people. But every now and then, I should get the ball from the halfway line or 30 yards out, beat 1-2 and smack it back.
Tell us about the goal of the season you scored. What year was that?
Yeah, same year, 81, 82.
Yeah, exactly.
Goal of the season, playing against Norwich. It was a cup game. Ali Robb just flicked it on. I was facing back to goal, heading towards the Smethwick end. It flicked onto me. I rolled it on my chest. Martin O'Neill come to challenge me. I gave him an elbow.
Yeah.
Went past him, went past Stevie Walford.
O'Neill goes down like a ton of bricks, yeah.
He later managed me. Went past him and I cracked it from about 25 yards into the top left-hand corner past Chris Woods.
I mean, a great goal and a great season for you. Were you very sad that you didn't get to go to a World Cup?
Very sad. I was playing well. Confidence was high. Ronnie Allen was, for me personally, was great as a manager. He understood that I never had a lot of stamina. So I used to be explosive in that half of the pitch, not chasing left backs and right backs and extending energy. So I could use my energy on a purposeful. Scored 24, 25 goals. And I can remember playing Leeds at home and we sent Leeds down. I think we beat him 2-0 or 2-1 and I pulled my hamstring. This was about two or three games before the season's ended. We sent Leeds down, pulled a hamstring. We went to Iceland with an England game. England stroke full team, stroke B team. I pulled my hamstring again and I was out of it for the England side. And I think Peter Whiff went instead.
I mean, after 82, 83 was kind of a disaster for you. You got a terrible facial injury, a broken cheekbone. I believe you've still got a piece of wire in your face now. And then although you still played and scored goals for West Bromwich Albion, is it fair to say that your powers or the team's powers, you fell away a bit in the following few years at West Brom? Is that fair?
I think sometimes you can look back and with a bit more clarity on what happened. I mean, Brian Robson went, the team had changed from the 78-77 side. There was good players there, but not top-class players. The team was changing. We weren't playing as well. Johnny Giles had came in. He was an absolute great manager. The lad adored him. The players adored him. But I felt, you know, he felt I lost a bit of sparkle. I was in my comfort zone. And I felt he'd lost a bit of passion coming back. And it didn't work out. He had got an offer from Coventry.
One of the pieces of furniture here at TalkSport, one Bobby Gould,
the manager.
What did Bobby say to you to make you go to Coventry? I mean, you'd been at West Brom and latterly you've been voted their great cult hero of all time. Forget about Tony Brad.
For 2 years, I didn't play well. After I broke my cheekbone, I was playing very well up to then. And for 2 years under Ronnie Allen and Ron Wiley, I was playing while I was injured. You know, because they wanted to go out there, the hamstring problems, my form was off, I wasn't playing well, and they dragged me out 50%, 60%, and you think, okay, I'll go do it. But my form suffered.
Let me ask a personal question, because I'm sitting here, I'm 4 feet away from you, and you're a very, very fit-looking man. Were you heavier when you were playing football than you are now?
No.
You give the impression of having been stockier in those days. I'm just wondering
that was a tight kit.
Maybe the 80s tight kit. Yeah, that'll be it.
Kit was tight those days, and the muscles used to be bulging out.
Because if you were like you and you're getting injured, I often think footballers are never quite fully fit. They get back to some kind of fitness, then they play again, then they get hurt again, and they're never quite fully fit.
Well, you need a high pain tolerance when you're a footballer.
So Gould comes along, and we all know that he's a live wire. What did he say to you to make you join Coventry City?
Well, I did want to go. I've got to put my hands up. Yeah. I did want to go. I had 2 years left on my contract, and I thought, well, when it got out in the papers, the Sawridges might be going to Coventry, there might be better clubs coming for me. But when it got out in the papers, no one did. And that hurt me. Here I was, you know, could have gone to Snetien for £750,000. We nearly went to the World Cup in
England
82.
Centre forward,
scoring goals for fun. And all of a sudden, for 250 grand, no one wants me. And it's like, wow. So I made a heartfelt decision, not a career decision. I said, right, I'm going to go to Coventry and show you how good I am.
Did you feel, before you made the move to Coventry, your career might even slip away from you?
Not so much at West Brom, but more at Coventry when I went there.
You didn't enjoy it at the start, did you?
I went for Bobby Gould. Bobby Gould persuaded me to go over there.
He's an infectious character. He could sell a snow to Eskimos, as people say.
Yeah, and he's going to, you know, get built aside. I wanted to show people how good I was. But I made a wrong choice. And the sad thing was Bobby Gould got the sack after 2 months.
As can happen, yeah.
So you go to a football club and everybody's saying, how did you get to Coventry? Why did you go from West Brom and England and Coventry? And that ranked with me. That, you know, I possibly made a wrong move. Bobby Gould had gone. Don Mackay became the manager. And I just thought, well, I'm in the abyss. Coventry was a poor side. I was a big fish in a small pond. All the focus was on me, all the pressure was on me. I wasn't playing well. I wasn't scoring goals. And it was a very, very low point. Very low point in my career.
How did you get out of that?
Well, the catalyst, I've got to say, was John Sillett and George Curtis.
An unusual couple, because one had been kind of one of the youth team bosses, the other had been the physio or something like that.
He was a great player, George Curtis for Villa and Coventry.
On a big man mountain.
And they adored and learned all the management skills from Jimmy Hill in the 70s at Coventry.
He'd been the club's commercial director. That's right.
That's right. Don Mackay got the sack.
Yeah.
We had three games to stay up. 95-96 season.
Yeah.
And Johnny...
85-86.
Sorry. John took over. And he basically said, you win two games, we're going to get a Magaluf, whether we go up or down. Anyway, we won three games. We beat Stoke away, Luton at home, Everton, who had won the league. We beat them at home. We stayed up by the skin of our teeth and sent Norwich down. Went to Magaluf for a week. That was great. And it was while in Magaluf, John went to all the players and said, how do you guys want to play? And he got a system of playing that suited everybody. We all bought into the philosophy. We all had an input. And John was like Ron Atkinson, a fantastic motivator, great man manager, new football, knew how to generate a team spirit. And for another 4 or 5 years, it was great.
And that 4 or 5 years includes what we should talk about for the next 5 or 6 minutes, or 7 minutes, 8 minutes, as long as I can stand it. I'm not being funny. It came up the other day. Clive Allen was sat in the chair where you are, of course, who played in that 87 Cup final on the opposition side for Spurs. It still rankles with him. Spurs were such favourites.
I think
the 87 FA Cup final, we'll talk about the run in a second. One thing I want to say about it is that because what followed the following year, Wimbledon against Liverpool, was such an amazing thing, it has caused us to overlook that the 1987 FA Cup final was a brilliant football match, 3-2 to Coventry, and B, almost as big an upset, because Spurs were a fantastic team at that time. And I do feel that the shadow of 88 has left 87 rather isolated.
I agree with you. If anybody just goes and looks at the two games,
the spectacle, there's no comparison.
It was a fantastic game. I was the only ex-England international, and Tottenham had 14. I mean, people were saying we're going to lose 3-1, 4-1, everything like that. But we knew we had a strength of character. We knew we could beat Tottenham on our day. There was no pressure on us. And Dave Bennett was phenomenal. And Keith Houchin, who couldn't score in the league, he was scoring for fun in the cup run. He scored a memorable goal, a diving header.
You mentioned David Bennett. He had been in the Manchester City team that played in that famous cup final of 82 when Spurs got the better of them in arguably one of the greatest finals ever. I'm not saying he was out on a revenge mission, but for a player who was a good player, but I don't remember being a great player, on that day, he was a great player. Everything he did had meaning. He was everywhere. He scored a goal, and I'm delighted to say we can even talk to him now thanks to the miracle of modern radio. Good evening. Hello, Dave Bennett.
Hello, how are you?
Ben, very, very good indeed. How are you, pal? All right.
How are you, CR?
I'm good, man. I'm good.
Dave, I'm, as you can hear, as a Spurs fan, I'm still rather smarting quarter of a century later about that. But you played, I mean, we'll talk about the run in a minute, but the final itself, you had an inspired game.
Well, if you're going to have a game, that's the time to do it. You know, the old cup run, not only me, it's a team game. You just start on the day, everything clicked. But as a team, as a unit, we were very strong and we always had a chance. We always thought that we could always beat Tottenham if we play our game.
Did you still think that when you went behind to Clive Allen's goal? I think he's 49th of the season after 2 minutes.
Well, at the time, if Steve will remember, with me and him are kicking off and we're talking to each other about keeping the score down.
That's right, yeah. Let's keep it down to 3 or 4. Don't be embarrassed by losing the cup final 5-0 or something.
So I haven't had a touch yet, so I'm kicking it off, making sure I get a touch. So that's how we're thinking at the time, because they started like a house on fire and we just thought, you know, we've got to get back into this game somehow or some way.
And of course, 5 minutes later, Allen's goal was wiped out by one D. Bennett.
Yeah, at the time, all season, I've been playing up front with Cyril. Me and
that's
Cyril.
Right, yeah.
And as they say, I was looking after Cyril, making all the runs down the channels.
That's
everything
my stamina,
like that.
Mate, my stamina.
But fair dues to the big man. The big man used to after me in more ways than one, because we used to play against these few centre-halves. And the first thing they used to say was, don't get the big man round. Don't get the big man round. Don't upset him. Don't upset Cyril. So all he used to do was take it out on me. So then I used to say to Cyril, as we used to talk in a little bit of patois, hey, this guy's having a go at me, and Cyril used to sort him out.
David, just as on a personal level, just let me ask you this. I mean, obviously it is the greatest day in Coventry City's history and it was a fantastic cup final. Did it mean any more to you because you'd been beaten by Spurs 5 years earlier?
Yes, of course it meant a lot to me in the sense that that game in 1981 was a great cup final, and as a young lad, you go in there and you don't take it in as much because it's an occasion where you don't want to let it pass you by. So when it comes to 1987, I was making sure that weren't going to pass it by. So it meant, yes, a little bit of revenge for all the lads up in Manchester, but also a big part of it was for Coventry City, for the way we played and the lads, how we've gone about it.
Well, listen, you've got the equaliser. Gary Mabbott scored again for Spurs. Keith Houchen got that fantastic diving header to equalise. And in extra time, an own goal by Gary Mabbott, God help us, means that Coventry had won that final by 3-2 and beaten a Spurs side containing Richard Gough, Gary Mabbott, Clive Allen, Chris Waddle, Glenn Hoddle, Aussie Ardiles. I won't go on.
Internationals, great memories. You know, in football, the sweetest sound is the last whistle, because you never know what's going to happen in football. And you're just waiting for that last whistle. We're all tired. The old Wembley was quite spongy, so with my stamina, I was absolutely wrecked after extra time. And that final whistle was like, wow. I looked up and it was 3-2. It was, as we were talking earlier, your dream was to, you know, we used to play football, and there's a kids called Wembley, knockout competition. We always wanted to play at Wembley. Always, you know, dreamt of being in the FA Cup final. Actually do it and win was just absolutely amazing. I think one doesn't realise what football means to community until you win something. It will win something big. The feel good factor in the city, people who supported Coventry, lived in the area. I mean, we're still riding on it now, and that is nearly 25 years later. Still riding the
fact. Did you have an open top bus parade for the city?
We did. Yeah, there were 200 people.
It's a brilliant thing, isn't it?
It's just
200,000, I hope.
200,000. Yeah. 200,000 people in Coventry. They're so proud of the city. The first thing they've won in 104 years of history is just amazing. How, you know, you can give so much joy to so many people.
I take it the drinking culture was still slap bang in English football. I take it the celebrations were pretty wild as well.
Oh, just, we went to Magaluf after that for a week and had to come back for a rest.
Well, it was a great day, and I'm glad, despite the Tottenham angle, I'm very glad to let people remember it, because I believe that's a cup final that, as I say, has been slightly lost to history because of what happened the following year. Did you feel that your kind of return from I wouldn't call it a wilderness, but the dark place you'd got yourself into, it was complete.
Definitely. I was playing good football. I was consistent. In those dark days, you had to dig into your character. And I tell a lot of young players, it's not just about your actual talent, your ability. You had to dig in your character or your resolve or your self-belief. That was severely tested in those days. But for John and George and the boys and the team at Coventry, got back a bit of self-respect from a playing point of view. And after that, I was very, very consistent. And that's what you need as a footballer. You need a high level of consistency week in and week out. And I managed to get that.
Yeah, and I think you were playing some excellent football then. Although Coventry didn't get to compete in the European Cup Winners' Cup because of the ban.
That's right,
which is a shame for everybody concerned.
Yeah, it would have been great for Coventry getting there to Europe.
And in October 87, you made your final of 5 England appearances. Those were days when England could beat Turkey 8-0. Those days are not with us anymore.
That's
to be
right.
Fair.
No, absolutely.
You came on and when it was 6-0, and I was going to say, you talked about the great players that were up against you to get into the England team. Still in all, I suspect that given what you achieved in the game, you might be disappointed with only getting 5 England caps.
Definitely. But, you know, we look back and look at the dynamics. If my career was again, I probably maybe should have left West Brom in 81, 82. Maybe gone on to Pastors New, perhaps. And Albion was on the way down because Brian Robson had gone, Big Ron had gone, Albion's on a slippery slide. I had a very good year. From a career point of view, on reflection, I should have left then, 81, 82.
And gone on to, if not a bigger club,
a bigger club. Because I was, I was Midlands Player of the Year. Won the goal of the season. I came second to Kevin Keegan in the Players Player of the Year. So I could have had a choice of clubs, but decided to stay. And but that was a juncture in my career. Looking back and in reflection, should have left West Brom then.
Okay, you're at Coventry City, and we've described that triumph in the FA Cup. But of course, it also the FA Cup, because that's what the competition does, brings you one of the most remarkable results in the entire history of the competition. I remember the game very clearly and with no sense of vengeance, because 18 months after that cup final, at the start of the 89-90 FA Cup, 7th of January 1989, Sutton United, a 2-1 defeat for top-level Coventry City. Tell us about the game.
Painful times. I mean, we've just gone through Coventry winning
the cup. You were third in the first division, incidentally.
It was a half thanks.
It's a fact. I'm just looking at the league table here in front of me.
But it was painful. I mean, winning the cup two years before, you had come
out of non-league football.
Sutton United.
Exactly. You'd come out of non-league football. You I guess you must have known you should beat those, but they are still blokes who can play.
Yeah, but it was one of those games that we just didn't turn up. We didn't play well. Arkell had scored a couple of goals. They had about three chances. They scored two goals. We hit the bar. I put around a post. We had 15, 15, 16, 20 chances. And the pitch was bobbly. It was classic Dave and Goliath situation. And we lost 2-1.
They got a kind of mad scientist set piece goal as well, didn't they?
It just didn't happen for us in a day. And I can remember the feeling walking in the dressing room. John Schlitt, he said, can't say nothing to you. Can't bring you any lower because we've got a game Saturday. And so we just.
I mean, is there anger? Is there sadness? What's the feeling like in the dressing room after that? It only happens about once every 3 years.
It's shock. You just think, no, this can't happen. Why did it happen? There's no reason for it. You just can't. You probably need a PhD to analyse what happened. And it's just one of those. It's sport.
What's the form? Do you go to the Sutton dressing room and say, well done, guys? Or do you just get your head under a blanket and get yourself onto the coach?
Just walk away with your team, with your toes between your legs. I mean, they're celebrating for fun. You can see the dressing room, you know, which is...
I'm sure you can hear it, too.
Yeah. I hear the dressing room, you can hear it. Yeah, we've done them, yeah. Champagne is cocking, the boys are buzzing. And you think, oh, my Lord. But I tell you, the worst moment for me was you get back home, all of a sudden, is waking up Sunday morning.
Papers.
Oh, no, it's just, you think it's a dream. You wake up and it hits you. Sunday morning, you've lost 2-1 to Sutton, and all that feeling comes around. I think I must have been drunk for 3 days just trying to get out of my system. It was so painful.
Do you remember how you got on that next league game?
No, I can't. And it's one of those things that every time you... that's life, it's about balance, isn't it? You get the highs of winning against Tottenham, and you get the low of losing at Sutton United.
Well, if you're ever short of a drink these days, you can all just go down to the town of Sutton and probably buy you one, Cyril.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
In 1990... sorry, you're going to say?
But funnily enough, they went to Norwich the following round and got battered 8-0.
Yeah, I mean, but that's the more predictable result, isn't it? Yeah,
100%.
In 1990, sometime after that, Coventry were doing okay. They finished seventh and they're dropping down the league in the early part of the 1990s. Terry Butcher comes to be manager, and I think you did you. How did you get? I mean, you must have been in and around England squads with him. Do you know Terry?
Yeah, I've known Terry from the England squad. Didn't know him.
No,
very, very well. I think he was playing up in Rangers in Scotland.
Sure.
John Schlitt got the sack and Terry became manager and he wanted to change things around. I think he wanted some younger legs. He got rid of Brian Kilcline, a few older people, Trevor Peake later on. And I was third.
We could do a whole 2 hours on Brian Kilcline.
Yeah, absolutely.
We?
What yeah. a great character. And I was 33 at the time. I was playing fairly well, and I thought he wanted to freshen up the squad. He brought in Mick Mills and Brian Eastick as coaches. He wanted to freshen up the squads. We were in our 30s, and he bought Robert Rosario for £600,000.
That didn't turn out too well, did it, to replace you?
I mean, no disrespect, you know. I'm not singing me praises, but Robert Rosario...
You could say he was a big guy.
He scored 10 goals in 10 years. His career before he went to Coventry, right. £600,000. But I think, you know, managers live or die by the decision making. He let me go.
I should make the point. He got 10 goals in 10 years as a centre forward.
As a centre forward, yeah.
You're not impressed with that, I can tell.
I'm not, no. But I mean, end of the day, managers made a decision. I see Robert Rosario, you know, now, and he's fine. He's not his position.
He wants to make. He's just making a living, isn't he?
But Terry Butcher, if he thinks that, you know, Robert Rosario is better than me at 33 at £600,000. It's his decision.
What did you make? You mean you had to move on again?
And I did.
And very lucky, really, because Ron Atkinson by this time is manager of Aston Villa.
How can you go from Coventry to Aston Villa? You know, people have different values, don't they? And they see different players. In fact, the whole Coventry fans for the last 2 months of the season were saying Cyril must stay. The whole fans were saying, but you know, he had to do a job to do. I went, and Ron Atkinson went to the Villa, and I was his first buy on a free at 33.
And you did very well. You
great, scored great 2 years. Yeah. Yeah. Great 2 years there. Played with some magnificent players. Dwight York, Paul McGrath, Gary Parker, Ray Houghton, Bojnic, Teal.
Characters too.
Kevin Richardson, winners. The first year, 91-92, played with Yorkie up front. We brought Daley Atkinson, another gifted player.
Beast of a man as well.
Yeah. We come seventh in the league. Ron tweaked it again. 92-93 was the first year of the Premier League. And we come second to Man United.
Absolutely.
I never played a lot because I had an ankle injury, but Dean Saunders was there up front, Medallion, and Big Ron. That was a hell of a side. Great, great
you
side.
You enjoyed Aston Villa.
I mean, we had talented players. I mean, as I said before, the team spirit at Coventry was the best in my footballer career. But two great teams were West Brom and the Villa side in terms of pure talent. Was fantastic.
I mean, obviously, by this stage, you're a legend in the Midlands. So, you know, the time comes to leave Villa. You're now in your mid-30s.
35.
Everybody still wants to give you a go, and you go to the last of the big teams, with all due respect to Birmingham in the West Midlands.
Oh, there's still
little,
time. There's
little
still time.
Wolverhampton Wanderers,
still
yeah.
Still time, yeah. Well, I could have gone over to...
Well, I think... let me get this right. Graham Turner was in charge when you went, but Graham Taylor very quickly came.
That's right, yeah. Well, I could have gone out to... I could have joined David Pleat down at Luton. And John Rudge at Port Vale wanted me. Could even gone out to Cyprus to Limassol.
Yeah, but you must know where Molyneux is, mustn't you?
Absolutely,
it's easy to find.
But you know, coming from West Brom, it's the arch enemy, Wolves. But it was another chance to stay at home with the family, I liked what Graham Turner said. We had two good players there in Steve Ball, great player, and David Kelly. I didn't play a lot of games, but it was close. Good little side. Had some great players there and stayed there for a year.
I mean, I always think, and we'll talk about the next part, I think players were far too quick to retire in those days. You don't realise, I guess, how long the road of life... I mean, no matter how busy you are, is lying ahead of you when you give up playing football. I'm glad to see you kept going. You got a call from a very famous football person, the commentator Alan Parry, trying to make a meeting for you with a very young manager. We heard about him earlier in the piece when you knocked him over to score your goal against Norwich. Then the still very, very young Martin O'Neill, and he persuaded you to go. I think it was his first management job at Wickham Wanderers, wasn't it?
I think it was Grantham before that.
Was
and then
he?
They went to Wickham. But I'll just go digress a little bit. When I left Wolves, it was one of the most painful times because you're waiting for the phone to ring. And the phone don't ring.
I had you hadn't thought of retiring. You just wanted to play
I
on.
I wanted to play football, I was 36. Yeah. Wanted to play. I had two calls. One was from Kenny Swain at Wigan. Already wanted for me to come up there for 3 months. Because don't forget, you're 36. People thinking if you've still got the legs, that
kind
of stuff.
Sure.
And Liam Brady was at Brighton. He wanted me to come down there just for 3 months. I went, no, you know, it's a bit of pride. You know, you want me, I want a year. And he said, I couldn't offer that. So I'm waiting. Everybody's doing pre-season. I end up doing pre-season with my brother at Southend and doing some stuff myself. And a week before the season starts, I get a phone call from Alan Parry. He says, sir, what are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. He says, no, I've had a couple of offers, but nothing. And then the following day, he said, you've met from Wickham, Martin O'Neill down there. The following day, I met Martin O'Neill at Warwick, Hilton Hotel Warwick. Sat down for 7 minutes, done a contract, and signed for a year at Wickham Wanderers.
And, all right, so you're playing in the lower leagues now. How did you enjoy that?
Great fun. Martin O'Neill, what a fantastic motivator. I mean, no wonder he's gone on to do fantastic things with Norwich and Celtic and Villa because he's a great motivator. He's old school in the sense that, you know, he gets players, he can build a good side and gets the players to do their maximum. And it was a tremendous, great year. We had a very good side there.
As you've seen with his teams, I mean, I'm thinking particularly about the Leicester team, which Emil Heskey led so well. He likes a big, strong centre-forward, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does, because it gives you an option. Someone who could do it on the pitch, but then on the ground. But if the ball needed to be a bit longer, who can hold the ball up, flick it on, have that power up front. So it gives you an option. If you've only got small lads up there, you can only keep it on the ground, and you haven't got that aerial ability. So it was great with Martin O'Neill down there with some excellent players, Stevie Brown and Big Terry. It was excellent.
I mean, and you got your share of goals again. You got into double figures down at Wickham.
I did. It was great that year. Played some real good players and managed to get Jason Roberts, who's just left Chelsea. I got him in as an apprentice.
I mean, you should make the point again, for those who didn't join us an hour ago, that he is your sister Nilla. Is that
right? Yeah, my eldest sister Nilla. Yeah,
Jason is your you've taken your nephew under your wing.
Yeah, I took him into Wickham with me, but it didn't work out for him there.
Very similar kind of player in some ways, perhaps not with the rocket burner pace that you had once you got the ball at your feet.
No, but,
is that fair or unfair?
No, Jason was a winger.
Yeah.
Jason was always brought up as a winger, all his football life as a winger. He only changed to an out-and-out forward when it went non-league to Hayes, and then that's when he's made his name as an out-and-out forward.
So you had your year with Martin O'Neill, and we couldn't get rid of you. You still wouldn't go. You moved to Chester City to play. I mean, what did you know? I mean, did you know anything about Chester City?
Nothing. Kevin Redcliffe tried to...
Wales, yeah. and of course, a great Everton captain in his time.
I think he's trying to get me before that, and I went to Wickham.
Well, let's find out why he did. Here is the former Everton and Wales skipper, legend, of course, in that great Everton side of the mid-80s, Kevin Redcliffe. Hello, Kevin.
Hi, lads. How are you?
Hi, Kevin. How you doing, pal? All right.
I'm all right, mate. Yeah, you?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, Kevin, I mean, I watched you play. You were a sensible and direct man and all the rest of it. What made you want to sign a 37-year-old centre-forward?
Well, I had a young lad at the time, a lad called John Murphy. He was a centre-forward, and he's an old-fashioned, typical type of centre-forward, you know, big lad, good touch and everything. But I wanted somebody really to teach him the ropes, and... Cyril fitted the bill, and Cyril was my first signing as a manager. And I think it's important that when you're a manager, you know, your first signing, that sets your stall, and Cyril come in. I think we had a little bit of an agreement that he did a couple of days a week and trained at home.
Yeah, that's right.
Which, you know, it suited both parts, really. And, you know, I also had a little bit of an agreement that I'd take him off 15 minutes ago so he could get a great round of applause, and he did.
Kevin, that was out of my stamina, though.
Kevin, before you were his manager, what do you remember? I mean, you must have come directly head-to-head with him as footballers. What do you remember about Cyril the player?
Yeah, well, you know, it's very, very difficult to sort of muscle him out of a game. You know, you have to sort of wait for mistakes, really, off Cyril. In his younger days, he had a little bit of pace as well, you know.
A little bit, Kevin, a little bit.
Yeah, at 37, you do lose a bit as well, you know.
Absolutely.
But the thing with Cyril, at 37, you know, he still had a body of a 25-year-old, you know.
He's not doing too bad now, if I'm absolutely frank with you.
I know he's, you know, he looked after himself, and I think, like you say, you know, that, you know, coming up to Chester, and like I say, I think he trained Monday and Thursdays and Fridays, and you know, he did us a treat, and I think himself as well, that, you know, he's he did really well for us, and you know, like I say, taking him off towards the end of the game really to give this other lad a little bit of experience, but you know, the applause that he used to get coming off, because, you know, he still had that little bit of drive in him that he, you know, he wanted to do well and be successful and as he could be at Chester. And he did really well for us.
Did you enjoy it, Cyril?
Very much so. In fact, Kevin offered me another year, but I had an injury and I packed in after that, doing 19 years. But it was great fun.
I think it was down a rabbit hole, wasn't it?
Something like that. going around Chester races on pre-season. That's what it was.
He's blaming you now, Kevin.
It was a park, wasn't it? It was a park, and I was going round before training, filling it in with sand, and I missed one, and you fell down it. I remember that. You know, you did your ankle or something,
right,
wasn't it?
That's right. Yeah,
and it was part and parcel of lower league football, really, going around the pitch with a cone full of sand and filling the holes in before you train.
Yeah. Kevin, just a final question for you. I mean, obviously, the modern game has plenty to offer. The TV audiences proved that. The full grounds proved that. But we don't see many of the Cyril Regis type now in the game. A big, pacey striker, playing often with a partner. It's a dying art in the game, isn't it?
Well, you know, one of the reasons is there's no contact.
Yeah.
You know, the need for strikers like that. The strikers are actually moulded into a different type of striker now. You know, there is strikers like that, but they're actually moulded a different way because the contact has been taken away from it. You know, in our day when we played, there was full contact.
Mm.
I think it takes away a little bit of a game.
Yeah,
now,
I agree.
The way it the
does,
game
yeah.
is. It takes a hell of a lot away from the game that I played. And, you know, I still see better games now, I feel, when there is contact in the game. And you usually get them when you're watching lower league teams, you know, from the Premiership.
Perfectly
you know,
right.
Take away the Premiership away, and after that, you see that. And I think the referees are not scrutinised as much, and you know they let things go a little
well,
bit.
I also think because of the lack of contact now that's allowed or appeared to be allowed at the very top level, that's one of the things, Kevin, ironically, and Cyril, is encouraging people to dive and cheat because they know that any contact, like they can get something out of the game, whereas before the referee might say, "Get up and get on with it."
Yeah, it was an art. Tackling was an art, but now it's a fading art with television and scrutiny. And playback, you get one thing wrong. With the amount of money in the game, one decision could go wrong for you, and you could be out.
Well,
could be relegated.
I think as well said, a lot of people get injured in tackles these days because they don't know how to tackle.
Yeah. Well, they don't tackle these days.
They're not brought up in training to actually go out there and tackle.
I agreed.
Well, it's one of the things that I think that they'll need to reassess as the years go by. People won't pay to watch an exhibition. Listen, thank you very much, Kevin Ratcliffe. Who gave tonight's guest, the great Cyril Regis, his last go as a player. So you come up to retirement. Your feelings about retiring from the game after two decades?
I think at that time, you know that your body's had enough. This is playing football for 19 years, umpteen 13 operations. Physically, it was challenging, you know, rolling out of bed Sunday morning after a game. Kevin looked after me great. I used to play on a Saturday, have Sunday, Monday off, train or play on a Tuesday, have Wednesday, Thursday off, do a little bit down at home in Birmingham, come up on a Friday, play five-a-side, play Saturday. That was my routine. And he took me off for 15 minutes. But even after that, because it was quite physical, I mean, the following day, Sunday morning, your body's broken. You had to motivate yourself so much, you know, going to Scunthorpe away in front of 500-600 people.
I think there are more than 500-600, with all due respect to Scunthorpe.
And the whole thing had changed. I remember going to Chester. I had my kit. And for years, everything was done for you.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you have to bring your kit home. You have to bring your towel home, wash your own kit, wash your own boots. It was like, okay, that's the way it is. But I still love playing football. We had a very good side. Kevin liked to play some good football and it was great fun. Having come into the game late, you wanted to eke every
exactly.
Bit of
if
it.
You've worked on a building site, you can see what a privileged position you are to be, and you know, to be a footballer.
There's nothing wrong with the modern player, especially come through the academy and that kind of stuff. But they just don't have the context. They don't have that perspective of the other side of life, and you can see sometimes when they come out of the bubble, which is football, they really struggle
to
work.
Aren't they?
Yeah, it's a different world out there. But for me, coming from the building site, knowing what, in no present terms, real work's about, 5, 6, 10 hours a day in a building site, cold weather, hot weather, being told what to do, and then playing football for 19 years, having that contrast. You know, that love for football, you know, you want to eke every bit out of it because you know you're going back to the real world.
And so you retire. Talk to me about one of the parallel things to your football career. At some stage, you've become a born-again Christian. I'm not even sure what that means in the modern world, to be honest, Cyril. What do you understand it to mean, and how did you come to that pathway in life?
Well, I think as a footballer, you have, well-known footballer, you have two kind of lives. You have a private life and a public life. And obviously your public life, everybody knows about. But your private life is totally different. In our days as a footballer, it was play hard, work hard, play harder. So there's a lot of drinking, a lot of late nights and a lot of women. That kind of behaviour has a disaster effect on your relationship. Married man with two kids has a disaster effect. I wanted to change my life for a long, long time, but couldn't.
Divorced from your wife, Beverly.
Yeah, yeah. Had a really, really, you know, difficult private life. As you can imagine, coming home with all sorts of stuff flying around. The trust, the faith, the communications in a marriage, which is needed to sustain a marriage, that was blown apart. But a real catalyst of me changing, as well as that, was my best friend, Laurie Cunlam. He'd gone to Madrid. He's in Madrid and he had a career. He died in a car crash in 1988.
A very young man.
A young man. 2 years before that car crash, me and Laurie was drinking in Spain. And we similarly had a car crash 2 years before he died, where the car hit the barrier after a night out, skidded in its roof, and we both came out alive. We thought, great, we were very lucky. But when Laurie Cunningham died, it really rocked me. He's my best mate. He's died in a car crash. But what hit me like a sledgehammer, that he left everything behind. Money, cars, your fame, everything that the world says, you know, you are successful.
The trappings, yeah.
The trappings. And I thought, well, what's life all about? And to cut a long story short, I was brought up a Catholic. I started to go back to church. And a guy called Brian Hewitt, came over to my house. We sat down and he told me how much God loved me. I made a small prayer. Brian said, were you a Christian? I said, no, I'm not a Christian. So I said, do you fancy somebody come around your house? So a lad called Colin Day came around my house. We spoke for about 5 hours. He told me how much God loves me. So he told me how much God has forgiven me my sin. I made a small prayer that day for God to come into my life. Nothing happened that day. But 4 days later, I'm reading a little book. And as I'm reading this little book by Michael Green, I get this enormous sense of peace come over me. This peace which I cannot describe. And at that peace, I just sensed that Jesus Christ was in my room. I just knew that Jesus Christ was in my room. And for that day onwards, that reality that Jesus is real, from that day onwards, lived my life as a born-again Christian. Got baptized. It didn't save my marriage, but my mindset had changed, my behavior had changed, and got a great relationship with my children and my ex-wife Beverly now, and things are great.
And on a personal level, you have remarried and it's all good.
Julia, what wonderful lady. Yeah, it's great. 3 grandkids as well.
Well, I'm struggling to think of Cyril Regis the grandfather, but that's just because I still see you knocking Spurs defenders left, right and centre on your way to goal. Cyril, you hung up your playing boots in 1996. The following year, you returned to West Bromwich Albion, your spiritual home, if you like, as reserve team coach, alongside your former Albion mate, John Truick. How did it feel to go back to West Brom?
That was great. It's great to get back. I had done my coaching badges while I was at Wolves. I was a fully qualified A-licensed coach. I went for a couple of jobs as a manager. I went back to Wickham, actually, when just before John Gregory got the job. They kind of half offered me a youth team coach job, but never materialised. And West Brom came in and...
Sorry to stop you there. Let me ask you bluntly. The Rooney Rule, all that stuff, American football, as it happens this year, it's 2 white men who have coached the teams to the Super Bowl that we're going to see in a couple of weeks' time. Do you think that there is a glass ceiling for ex-black players who want to be managers in this country to do it with the colour of their skin?
I think so, yeah. I think
statistically, it's absolutely provable.
It is, and I think it just mirrors society. I mean, you go to anybody in a bank or in a job or big industry or big companies, they'll tell you the same thing. The NHS, the housing, they'll tell you the same thing. There is a glass ceiling when it comes to going into management.
What's this about? Because there isn't that problem in getting players of colour into football teams, but that's thing, though. It's measurable, I guess, is it?
Well, you're an Indian in parlance. You know, when you're a manager, you're a chief. You're the face of the company. You're telling people what to do. You're dealing with millions of pounds. And you've got great stereotypes that, you know, they can play football, but black people can't manage. You know, that kind of stuff. And do you want a black man or a black person being the face of your company if you're a big global company? So a lot of these people who are making their decisions on the board, what experience they have they got any prejudices, who knows? But, you know, like the police, like different institutions, you can't pin it down. It's like institutionalised racism.
It's
you
mercurial,
can't pin it down.
Yeah.
Well, you look at football clubs, you know, when you go to football clubs, is anybody in administration? Don't see it. Black, you don't see black people in administration.
Okay, well, you and your generation broke a taboo.
From a playing point of view.
Yes, you did.
From a playing point of view.
Can it be that we can break But exactly the same thing happened in America. American football, in my opinion, has always been 30 years ahead of the other sports in the world. And we had exactly the same arguments in America. And then people like Art Shell became coaches. And recently we saw a Super Bowl with two black coaches. And that issue is now dead and buried. And can we do it in this country?
I think, but they've had help with the Rooney Rule. I think it's a great rule in terms of it says that it's only an interview. But I think in an interview, you might think, you know what? I didn't see him like that. He's the one, and it gives you that confidence that insight, rather than saying, "Well, we're not going to give him an interview." The fact you can have an interview with two or three black guys and a whole range of people, that one black guy might just think, you know what, he's the right one for us. But if you don't even interview him, you haven't got a chance.
Well, you don't get to know them as people anyway, so.
Sure. Plus, it's always, I think with someone like Chris Hughton doing a fantastic job. Fantastic job, because not only is he a black manager, he's a successful black manager, and that's important. I think back in the 70s, if it was just players, but not successful players with a great side, it might have a different connotation, which then inspires other people. You asked me the question back then, did we realise what we was doing? The fact is, we couldn't see it because the likes of Dwight York and all the second generation was inspired by watching us play football. So therefore, the more black managers we see, the more it inspires more.
I didn't mean to come back to the race issue, but it just occurred to me about the managers, and I'm going to carry on with it now, because in recent months, we've had the Luis Suarez thing with Evra and John Terry, and those things happened. And your nephew, Jason Roberts, was at the very front of saying, we know, I mean, I think Jason's attitude is, we know what's been done, there's more to be done, let's do it. I'm not having it that this is enough. And also, we've seen some of it come back on the terraces. Did he talk to you about all of this, sir? Does he talk to you about all this?
Yeah, we speak, and I think...
Well, you're his agent, aren't you?
Yeah.
And so I guess, I hope you're also his uncle.
Yeah, absolutely. We speak about things, and I think you just can't have this slowness and the indifference when issues happen. John Terry, why has it taken a year to sort out?
Well, that meant that was I hate to use the word cancer, but it was something sort of rotting away in English football for a whole year.
Sure, sure. And we had a whole Suarez situation where Liverpool, I mean, Mitch judged the situation at all by backing Suarez and the whole situation. Yes, Steve Blatter saying, you know, just shake hands and walk away with things is one of those things. You have FIFA. Any time racing comes up, somebody gets a paltry €30,000 fine. It sends out the message. It's not serious.
Well, we had FIFA this week saying that Kevin Prince Boateng should not have done what he did at the game with Pro Patria. I mean, I understand why they think. I can see the complications of teams walking off the pitch, but at least they need to support him personally.
100%. I mean, if the authorities that be, the sanctions ain't strong enough. Well, the fans are going to say, well, the game's 2-0 up. We're still going to shout racial abuse and players are going to walk off. But if they know the sanctions is just is going to be, you know, at that competition or the next five games is behind closed doors, they'll think differently about it. But when the fine is €20,000 in a multi-million pound company, it doesn't give it the seriousness. And Jason and all the former black players now, they're saying, you know, it's enough's enough. You know, we've had this slow process. Get it sorted. We've had this for a long, long time. Get it sorted. We're not having that slow process. You know, we've been there 30 years. It's a slow process. No one's taking it seriously enough. And, you know, we're making a stand. And good for them.
I mean, Jason did put his head very much above the parapet there, and plenty of people had a shot at it.
Well, you know, if you have the conviction that things are right life is about justice, fair play, and fighting against these sort of evil, and rightly so. I'm very proud of him.
Good, absolutely spot on. People are very proud of you, I mean, as well. In 2004, you were voted by West Bromwich Albion's all-time cult hero. What did that feel like?
I don't know about that. I mean, Tony Brown is top
see,
man.
See, I would have thought Tony Brown, but perhaps younger people remember you a bit
but
better.
I think for me, looking back, it epitomises... You know, that Roy the Rovers feeling, young kid plucked off the building site, playing on a Sunday morning. And a lot of fans could probably identify with that and wish that happened to them. you know, playing for the Dog and Duck on a Sunday, and, you know, their local club, seeing them play, come and play for us, and they're scoring goals at Wembley. And so I just epitomise that story.
You do. Indeed you do. I mean, there's so many other things I want to talk about, but let me just ask you about being an agent. How long have you been an agent, Cyril?
About 13, 14 years. Love it.
Yeah. Enjoy it?
Yeah. You love football.
I mean, they got a terrible rap, don't they, outside of the, you know, among fans like me. I won't hide it. In media as well, they've got a terrible reputation.
The bottom line is, I always say, in every profession, there is 10% of people who are wrong-ins. Same as our profession. Same as any drinking industry, music industry.
Not broadcasting industry. No way.
Honestly, they're wrong-ins. And the same as our business. And I think they always focus on the fact that, you know, they're earning big money in terms of wages, in terms of fees. But one of the saddest part of, the hardest part of my job is when 16, 17, 18-year-olds who's been in a football club for 10 years get released. That is painful when they've had their dreams shattered. And it's a conveyor belt of, you know, if you're not good enough, out you go.
It's brutal, isn't it?
It's brutal.
And it's brutal on those teenage kids. I mean, later on, professional footballers can look after themselves. I understand, you know, when, if you've got two Premier League contracts, you're made for life, and after that, it's down to you to make the best of your talent. But there are kids being chucked out of, you know...
But no one talks about that. When you're 16, you've been in an academy for 5, 6, 10 years, at 16, if they are not good enough, you're out.
What do you do? What do you say to kids who you're the agent of, who don't make it?
Well, one, you've got to encourage them. Listen, it's not over. You've got to keep telling them stories about, I come from non-league, Jason Roberts,
Stuart Pearce.
It doesn't matter. Keep going. You've got to lift them up. Their morale, their self-esteem is down. They, you know, nothing happens. You've got to go and find them football clubs, encourage them. All those things to get back on the ladder. Because if you ever got an agent, it's not your mum and dad. Your mum and dad's only got the contacts, their whereabouts, who to speak to. And it's very challenging, very challenging. And the fact is, the career path is not academy, under-16s, under-18s, first team. That's not how it works. Most of the time, a player has to leave between 18, 19, 20, go two or three levels down, find a club, and then work his way back in again. And that's the way it is.
Yeah.
And being an ex-player, one of the things I love about the game is mentoring young players and saying, listen, you might have these rose-tinted glasses of what a professional footballer is like, but this is how it is.
I've only got about 90 seconds left, and I want to talk about the future, but give me 30 seconds on the fate of, not of, of West Bromwich Albion, who are doing so well, but of Coventry City, who you've done so well with, and now...
It's painful.
I know they're turning the form around a little bit right now, but the club is in a terrible place.
Well, financially, it's an absolute mess. And this is what you see when you have bad financial management. The club has got to be the fulcrum of the city, the community. Whoever looks after the club's got to think long-term ahead. I mean, Coventry went down with £60 million worth of debt. They sold Highfield Road. You know, there's no assets. The assets are only players. The players are worth £5 million.
It's literally unmanageable with that kind of debt on it. It's literally unmanageable.
I don't know where they go. It's absolute nightmare that because of mis financial management. When you think about West Brom, it's run financially right.
Yeah, but Coventry, Jeremy Pease is a very smart guy, and he's not going to sell the
club. This is our budget.
Yeah.
This is our budget. This is our operate. We're not going to go borrow 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 million pounds to get success. We operate within those limits.
Yeah, because I'm not sure now. When I see Coventry and I see Portsmouth,
it's painful.
Both of them FA Cup winners in my memory. Yeah. I worry that they're not blips. They might be the forerunners of what's going to happen to a lot of clubs, and we shall see. Yeah. It takes us to the future, Cyril. It's been an absolute joy listening to you talking. And you're right, it's a fairy tale in many, many ways. Not all of it, but much of it. You know, boy from the building sites, playing for England, scoring goals of the season, being a top player, and all the rest of it. What do you think? Where the road will take you? Where do you hope that road will take you?
Well, I'm enjoying my job as a football agent. I work for a company called Stella. Jonathan Martin and David Manassi, fantastic people to work with. I really enjoy mentoring young players, seeing them fulfil their potential as a footballer, for one side. Doing the work I do with WaterAid, the Jason Roberts Foundation.
Yes, absolutely.
And Christians in Sport. And three, from a Christian's perspective, telling people about the love of God.
You've been listening to an archive edition of Talk Sport's My Sporting Life with Danny Kelly. Thanks for listening. And make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Acast, and Spotify for more top TalkSport content.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.